Hello, my name is Anthony Patch, and this is another edition of Pulse. We are going to take a look at some of the geopolitical issues of the day, specifically Russia, Ukraine, and the Middle East issues surrounding Iran and Israel. The title is De-escalation and Escalation. It is Tuesday, the 15th of October of 2024. Sunday, we produced a two-hour live stream, as we always do on Sunday, Tuesday, and Thursday evenings of each week. We produce two-hour live streams in which we cover geopolitical issues, economic issues, science and technology such as quantum mechanics, quantum physics, operations like CERN in Geneva, and so forth and so on. There's a great deal of information that I'm restricted from presenting here on the YouTube platform due to community standards, which we abide by. We support that. We take no issue with that, other than to say that we have our own private streaming platform where we are more liberty to dive into the deeper details of the events of today and tomorrow. Today, what I'd like to start with is Israel and Iran. Over the past several days, Israel reportedly has been conducting cyber attacks against Iran's nuclear research facilities, their banking and finance sector, as well as their broader communications systems. I believe that this portends an imminent attack on Iran by Israel, and that's what I'd like to focus on tonight. There has been a great deal of coverage since the retaliatory strike by Iran on October 1st of a tit-for-tat, if you will, a retaliatory strike by Israel against Iran. So we've all been expecting this. We've all been wondering, when is this going to happen? Now, I don't have any insider information as to when it will happen, but it certainly appears to be imminent. So when we look at things like a softening up of the technical, the internet, the communications, the financial sector of Iran, that I think is pretty self-evident that things are leading up to a military strike by Israel, which will predominantly be a military missile attack, along with fighter bomber dual use F-15 fighter aircraft and so forth and so on. I think it's important to understand that, and again, I'm presenting this information from a journalistic perspective, not taking sides, just reporting the information. But it does appear that there's a warning that has come out from the Biden administration warning Israel, Netanyahu, and his war cabinet not to strike the nuclear research facilities in Iran, nor the oil production facilities. I think if we look at the past as an indicator of the near future with respect to Israel, there is a pattern of actions or behavior on the part of Netanyahu and his war cabinet such that they pretty much act independent of the United States while dependent upon the United States for financial and military and even political support. So there is a de-escalation and an escalation that is taking place. The escalation is Israel, the broader Middle East region, while a de-escalation in terms of Ukraine and Russia, which I will get to in the second half of this brief presentation. The issue is with regard to the United States and Israel is that the United States is, at least in the public arena is putting forth a posture of moderation, encouraging Israel to not strike these two groups of facilities, nuclear and oil. It's my conclusion, just based on looking at different sources of information, that Netanyahu will continue his pattern of behavior, such as he has ignored the United States for the most part, not seeking prior permission, despite his visits to Washington and so forth and so on. I think he will ignore what Washington is saying publicly. Thus, I do expect that he's going to strike the nuclear facilities. There have been members of his own cabinet that have said that there is a narrow window of opportunity, that this is the right time to strike the nuclear facilities, that this will be the only opportunity for Israel to do so. So again, I'm reporting and paraphrasing statements that have been made. Now, Trump has said that absolutely, he has said this in several of his rallies and press conferences, Trump has said that Israel absolutely needs to strike the nuclear facilities. And Trump has even said this in a rather joking manner, a rather flippant manner. Yes, of course, the greatest existential threat are nukes, and this country has nukes. It is a rogue nation, again, paraphrasing Trump's statements. So Trump is there to encourage and push Israel as well. Even though he is not the sitting president, he does exercise a political influence insofar as his followers. So I think there's a strong case to be made that there is plenty of encouragement on the Israeli side to hit the nuclear facilities. What would be the result of that? Well, technically speaking, there would be a great deal of uranium and plutonium poisonous, these are classified as poisons, poisonous pollution within Iran itself. And depending upon how much of this material is cast up into the atmosphere, how much it is spread by the prevailing winds to other regions. Nonetheless, this would be, from an environmental standpoint, this would be a disaster. From a military standpoint, there is also an equality of disaster in the form of the response by not only Iran, but possibly Russia. There's no formal signature that's been affixed to a mutual defense pact between Iran and Russia. However, there is a draft that has been agreed to. And the reports indicate that this, I'm calling it a mutual defense pact. It's more than that. It's a trade agreement. It is a mutual support agreement, which does include security, but it's primarily an economic agreement because Iran is a member of BRICS, and I'll address BRICS in this mix in just a moment. The issue here is that during the BRICS meeting or immediately following its conclusion, which the meeting takes place in Russia between the 22nd, 23rd, and 24th of this month, and Russia is, of course, hosting this BRICS meeting. It's a BRICS summit. Nonetheless, as a member of BRICS, but also soon to be a signator to an economic and security agreement with Russia, Iran can expect support. And Russia has said, Putin has said, that if the nuclear facilities are struck in Iran, Israel can expect Russia to respond in defense of Iran. This even extends to, should there not be an attack on the nuclear facilities, which of course are deep underground in concrete and steel reinforced hardened bunkers in multiple locations with redundancy. And then for a lot of this is not only the research and development facilities, but also the highly sophisticated latest generation centrifuges for the enrichment of uranium. The issue here is that even if these facilities are not struck, Russia has made it clear that if there is a massive strike, air assault against Iran, not only by Israel, but by the United States, that Russia will attack Israel itself from Russia. So I'm not going into the depth of discussion. There are plenty of other platforms for that information, but I'm giving you the highlights in case you've not heard of these bullet points, so that you can then pursue that on your own for deeper understanding of the details. So Russia factors into the decision-making by the U.S. and by Israel. Certainly the United States in a public manner does not want to raise the ire of Russia such that then Russia is fighting a two-front war, the Middle East and Ukraine. However, I do think that behind the scenes, because there are enough individuals in the present administration that are pushing for war, not only with Russia, but pushing for war with Iran, that really there are back channel communications that are occurring between the U.S. administration and the Israeli war cabinet, such that Israel is quietly being told, go ahead and hit the nuke facilities. We've got your back. Biden has said that many times. We have your back, Israel. The intent from Netanyahu, and really what he has telegraphed, is that by launching a massive attack against Iran, whether or not includes targeting of the nuclear facilities, whether or not it includes the oil facilities, but a massive attack nonetheless, this has been telegraphed and expected by Netanyahu to draw the United States in to support this attack. This is why Russia is so concerned, because the United States, of course, is a nuclear power. Nuclear weapons systems are supposed to be a deterrent. It's supposed to be a deterrent, but we're not talking about just intercontinental ballistic missiles. We're talking about smaller, low yield in the area of 75 kilotons, low yield tactical nukes that may be employed by the U.S., by Russia. And there are even reports that Russia has delivered tactical nukes to Iran itself to be used against Israel. Israel, of course, has had for some 25 or 30 years their own short-range and medium-range and long-range missile platforms and aircraft, airborne platforms, quite capable of delivering nuclear warheads, of which Israel has some 350, by estimates, some 350 nuclear warheads. Not all of them can be delivered simultaneously, but a large number of them can be. So considering the concept of simultaneous, my expectation here, again, just based on things that I've been looking at, my expectation with Israel is that this will be a massive attack. And by Netanyahu's own statements, Israel is now fighting a seven-front war. In other words, there are seven primary targets, seven primary enemies of Israel right now. So my expectation in a massive attack against Iran, this will include all seven fronts. So, of course, this is Lebanon to, I'm calling it, the left flank, the northern flank of Israel, if you're viewing Iran on the map. The left flank is Lebanon, which is Hezbollah. This The right flank to the south is Yemen, the Houthis. To a certain extent, you can include Hezbollah in the Gaza Strip. But more importantly, the Houthis, because they are equipped with Iranian-provided missile systems that they've already demonstrated that they can reach Tel Aviv and perhaps any area in Israel with hypersonic missiles. These travel between 4 and 8,000 miles per hour. There are no missile interceptor systems on the planet that are capable of intercepting hypersonics, whether they're Iran's smaller versions or the larger versions supplied by Israel or by Russia to Iran that carry a larger warhead, a larger payload. So there's no defense against the hypersonics coming from the right flank. Iran itself has already demonstrated on October 1st that it has hypersonics that are able to penetrate the Iron Dome, and they did, and they struck military targets on October 1st. So we also have to include the West Bank. We have to include Syria now. Israel in the last few days has made some shallow incursions into, on the ground, some 800 meters, perhaps as far as a kilometer, maybe as far as 2 kilometers across the Israeli-Syrian border into Syria. For several weeks, there have been intermittent aerial strikes on Syria by Israel itself. Damascus, I'll point out, is the command and control center not only for the Syrian forces led by the Assad regime, but also for Iranian forces, specifically Hezbollah. The bunker system below the streets of Damascus extends seven stories below ground. And again, these are hardened bunkers. These are not just the earthen tunnels that are a catacomb of tunnels that extend out into the suburbs of Damascus, but this is an actual military command and control bunker system that no doubt at some point Israel is going to attempt to penetrate those bunkers. The only real way to do that, unlike what occurred in Beirut with the assassination of Nasrallah, who was in a bunker system, at that time in Beirut, what Israel used in terms of weapons were 2,000-pound bombs, approximately 82, and 82 of these bombs were delivered, of course, by aircraft. And these were in 2 or 3 waves of bombs being dropped, and they were in a very narrowly defined target location. What I'm describing is that they, in 3 waves of 2,000-pound bombs, they hit the apartment buildings above, leveled the buildings. Then the next wave cleared away the debris, and the next wave was able to penetrate the earth itself and collapse the bunkers below, killing the occupants, including Nasrallah. Israel does not have that luxury with regards to Damascus and that bunker system. The air defense systems of Syria that have been provided by Iran and Russia has some 2,000 troops in Syria that also have command leadership in the underground bunkers in Damascus. The only real way to collapse this bunker system with a single strike by Israel is by the employment of tactical nukes, probably 2 in the 75 to 100 kiloton yield range, the range of 75 to 100, that would be sufficient to both penetrate and then detonate below ground. These would be the so-called bunker busters. This is a high explosive conventional explosive warhead that is combined with a nuclear warhead. You have two separate warheads. The conventional detonates and opens up the Earth, allowing the nuclear device that is concurrent on the same missile to then penetrate deeper into the Earth, at which point it detonates and collapses the bunker system below ground. This will virtually wipe out Damascus. Damascus overnight will cease to exist. My point in elaborating Damascus is that this is part of the seven-front war that Israel is facing, and therefore I believe that the left flank, Lebanon, including Beirut, and southern Lebanon, the right flank, Yemen, and directly across 1,000 to 1,300 kilometers from Israel, Iran itself. And you also have the West Bank, and potentially you have Pakistan, who is a nuclear state, all of whom need to be hit, by my estimation, need to be hit simultaneously. Therefore, my expectation is not only is this a massive attack against Iran, but all of these other targets. If only Iran were targeted by Israel, this would leave the left and right flanks available to attack Israel itself. By attacking all seven fronts massively, that requires the United States, of course, to support this. But by doing that, from a strategic standpoint, from a tactical standpoint, a near-term goal standpoint, they are able to diminish the ability for those enemies, those seven fronts, to then retaliate against Israel. So this is a massive strike. And this leads me to really the bigger point of the discussion of Israel. Will Israel use tactical nukes? Now, I indicated Damascus. I think it's highly likely with respect to Beirut, but more specifically, all of southern Lebanon. Tactical nukes will be used, at least in southern Lebanon, perhaps one or two on Beirut. Yemen, the Houthis, they are certainly going to receive one or more tactical nukes. Iran itself, the only way to really definitively knock out deep underground nuclear facilities in hardened bunkers, again, like Damascus, is to employ tactical nukes. The oil facilities, those are soft targets. They can be hit with conventional and other targets around Iran. Let's go back to Hezbollah in southern Lebanon very quickly. Why tactical nukes there? Well, again, the massive, massive tunnel systems throughout southern Lebanon that have been under construction since 2006 when Hezbollah and Israel were last in conflict, the tunnel system is basically in two levels. The upper level, just below grade, is where the troops are deployed from to rise up out of the tunnels onto the surface to engage the Israeli troops, the IDF. The next level below that is a storage level throughout southern Lebanon for missiles. Now, for the most part, Hezbollah has been launching rockets for the last couple of years. They have been using drones, as they did against the military base just south of Haifa a few days ago. Hit the cafeteria, killed a number of Israeli troops, wounded, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of 70 people, 70 soldiers. Nonetheless, there are drones as well. But what really has not been used by Hezbollah are their precision-guided missiles, their medium-range missiles, which estimates range between 5,000 and 100,000. I mean, the broad estimates. But these missiles have been held in reserve. In order to penetrate these bunkers and take those missile systems out, the storage facilities, not the launchers, those are above grade, tactical nukes, again. And when you look at the mountainous terrain of southern Lebanon, you really cannot penetrate southern Lebanon on the ground. This is not conducive to armored vehicle, nor even boots on the ground, because again, Hezbollah has had all of these years, some 15 years, to prepare for this. So the IDF is outgunned and outmanned, and they know the only answer to Lebanon is tactical nukes. So if we look at that, then we can understand where Russia fits into this, because they will respond once Pandora's box is opened, once nuclear weapons have been employed. Then there's, by all reports and estimations and planning guides and scenarios, in this whole nuclear era, it is widely accepted that once one nuke is used, there is a rapid, almost automatic escalation by nations who are perhaps not directly involved, but launching their nukes. So we have Russia, we have North Korea, which has just been closing off rail and road access between North Korea and South Korea just over the last couple of days. North Korea is threatening South Korea with nukes, but North Korea has been providing artillery rounds and missiles and nuclear warheads to Russia and to Iran. And then China is also involved. So there can be a rapid escalation on the part of China that is not directly involved in the Middle East, but they are heavily dependent upon oil from Iran itself. So indirectly, but they have a vested interest, you bring in these nuclear powers, China, North Korea, Russia, and then, of course, the United States. Now, I'm not trying to say that this is going to happen, that this is a rapid escalation will inevitably take place. It is possible that Israel would launch tactical nukes, as I've described, and that would be the end of it. But I think that's highly unlikely. Therefore, I just want to paint that picture that this is a very serious situation that is not just conventional war. And this is not going to be just a small retaliatory strike by Israel on Iran. This, I think, is evident by the three-week delay since October 1st, three-week delay in a response against Iran by Israel. Now, it should be appreciated that both sides, Iran has made the statement over the years and just recently that Israel needs to be wiped off the map, that every Israeli needs to be killed. And they've said that in the last few days. Israel, of course, has said that Iran needs to be wiped off the map. So there is an obvious motivation to escalate to the maximum degree. The background on Israel right now is that their economy is nearly bankrupt. There's a huge division between the Israeli population in support or against Netanyahu and his cabinet. The Israelis, again, are facing a seven-front war. They do not have the luxury of a large standing army. And therefore, in short, they are left with very few options to wipe out Iran, which is their goal. I'm not promoting that. Iran, for its part, doesn't have a standing army such that it could cross some 1,000 kilometers with boots on the ground and invade Israel. Because Iran has made it very clear they do not want to engage the United States, which would be drawn into a ground war in defense of Israel. So both sides are limited in what they can do, which precludes them and then promotes them to having to use tactical nukes. There's been the debate that is Iran a nuclear state? Well, I think it's a foregone conclusion that, one, they have stated that within a matter of just a few days, they can assemble at least a half a dozen nuclear warheads. The other point to this is it's a foregone conclusion that already Russia and perhaps North Korea have already provided nuclear warheads to Iran. So rather than nuclear weapons being a deterrent, which since approximately World War II, Nagasaki and Hiroshima, nukes have been viewed as a deterrent, not a offensive weapon, but a defensive system. Here we're looking at a offensive employment of tactical nukes by two nuclear states, Iran and Israel. Again, there's no definitive that nukes are going to be used, but I think it is highly likely that they will be used in the Middle East. This is the escalation that is going on. So to keep this video brief, let's go to Ukraine and Russia. There's a great deal of motivation on the part of Netanyahu, from his people, from his war cabinet, from those in the United States that want a regional war against Iran, that are pushing Netanyahu, and Netanyahu realizes he has a very narrow window in which to achieve his goals. Likewise, we have a situation with Vladimir Putin in Russia that he's getting a great deal of pressure by the oligarchs in Russia to end the war. And this has been coming out in the last few days more and more in different reports, that the oligarchs are applying pressure to Putin to bring an end to the Ukrainian war, the special military operation, as Putin characterizes it. We have to go to BRICS as well. And on last Sunday's live stream, I elaborated on what I'm about to briefly introduce to you. This is I call this a thought experiment, okay? You could phrase it as conjecture, a what-if scenario. With that understood, I would like to outline the possibility that because Putin is under a lot of pressure to bring an end to the war, his own military cabinet wants to bring an end to the war because they don't want to suffer any more casualties on the part of Russian soldiers. And BRICS, as I said, is coming up on the 22nd. Russia is hosting the summit, and there are leaders, there are existing member nations and prospective member nations that will be attending these meetings in Russia. And it is my observation, and therefore my conjecture, that Putin does not want the problem of a war, of a conflict going on, in which there's the specter of long-range missiles or medium-range missiles, even short-range missiles, being launched into Russia while they're hosting the BRICS meeting. You see, strategically speaking, Putin has the long view in mind. This Ukrainian issue really is just almost irrelevant to the longer strategic goal, which is to set up a new asset-based global economy backed by gold with cryptocurrencies in each sovereign nation, and trade settlement of cross-border trade occurring through the Bank for International Settlements with its own token, crypto token called UNIT. All of this I outlined in the September edition of our Entangled magazine. I've laid out the outline, the construct of BRICS, who's involved, what is the blockchain infrastructure, what are the cryptocurrencies, what are the assets, and the shift from a debt-based paradigm for a global economy to an asset-based, which includes the coming reset of the global economy. All that is in the September issue of Entangled Magazine. So Netanyahu needs to get rid of this military conflict, this special military operation. My thought experiment is this. Russia is in a position of power, of dominance over Ukraine, over the West. The military strength, economic strength, political backing by the people, political backing by allied nations. I think the long and short of what I elaborated on Sunday is that I think Putin is going to declare a ceasefire before the 22nd, which is next week. What is that, Wednesday? Tuesday, next week, 22nd. It's possible, and I emphasize that this is just a possibility, but I do think there is some likelihood that he is going to say, we're going to keep the territory that we've gained in Ukraine, and the only military operation we will conduct ourselves in will be purely defensive. Now, it's up to the West whether they want to continue attacking, offensively attacking, Russian forces that are going to remain in place, and we will defend ourselves, meaning Russia, but we're not seeking to move further to gain more territory, nor to offensively kill any more Ukrainian forces, thus declaring a ceasefire with the hope that this will encourage the West to then likewise set down their arms, lay down their arms. And Putin has made it very clear he doesn't care whether the West wants to declare this as a victory on the part of the West. How they characterize it, he doesn't care. This is what he has said in the past, 2022, 2023. He has said, you can call it your victory if you want. We just want a ceasefire. I think this is, again, what he's going to repeat in saying before the 22nd. That will de-escalate things tremendously while the escalation is occurring in the Middle East. BRICS is of more importance to the nations of the world than what is occurring in the Middle East. Now, if the Middle East goes nuclear, then of course BRICS is irrelevant. But if it does not go nuclear in the Middle East, then BRICS becomes the preeminent agenda item for the world. So if we set aside the nuclear discussion and we say, okay, now we're looking at economics, now we're looking at global trade, we're looking at a new asset-based paradigm for the global economy. This takes us to the reset. And I'll give you another thought experiment in conclusion. If the Middle East remains at a conventional warhead, conventional weapons system conflict, that conflict can then be utilized as an excuse for the global internet to be switched off. Why? Why would the global internet be taken down? Because that collapses the debt-based global economy. This is the reset that the WEF has talked about for years. Since June of 2020, they've been talking about it, openly talking about it. And in that, all of the debts are forgiven. All debts go to zero. What needs to be appreciated is all assets go to zero, because assets in the debt-based system are actually debt-derived. They are derivatives. Thus, taking down the internet collapses the global paradigm of the debt-based economy. Then the internet is brought back up. It goes live again. This is Internet 3.0, the so-called semantic web. And with the new internet system, you have a new asset-based global economy, which is what BRICS is all about. And that infrastructure, that technical infrastructure, hardware, software, cryptocurrencies, blockchain, distributed ledger, all is in place, has been tested, and is fully functional. Parenthetically, I need to also add and emphasize, the United States is part of BRICS. Specifically, the U.S. Federal Reserve, with its central bank digital currency, of which all other sovereign nations have their own individual sovereign CBDCs already in place, already tested through the Bank for International Settlements, the BIS, through their M-Bridge project, which utilizes the unit cryptocurrency token for the settlement, the wholesale settlement of interbank transactions, leaving individual countries to conduct their sovereign trade within their borders using their own sovereign CBDCs. The United States already has tested their CBDC, and it is fully compatible with the BIS's Enbridge project system of settlement of cross-border trade using the U.S. CBDC. So the public discussion is, oh, BRICS is trying to destroy the U.S. dollar, to de-dollarize the world, to collapse the U.S. economy, and thereby the U.S. government. Well, behind the veil, the U.S. government, the Federal Reserve in particular, has already set up the CBDC for this new BRICS-dominated asset-based, which is a gold-based economy, an asset-based paradigm. And this is the new global economy. So the U.S. is all part of this. There may be, with the internet going down, there may be a short-term collapse of the U.S. economy, as well as all of the economies of every sovereign nation. By my estimation, this internet takedown will only continue for perhaps 3 days, and then the new internet will go live. So my point here is the infrastructure is in place. It's been fully tested. It includes the United States. The dollar is gone. It is replaced by the CBDC. And you have a system in which all trade within borders and cross borders is conducted based upon gold. And this explains why there has been massive purchases by China and other countries, including the United States Federal Reserve, of gold, because they're setting up for this new BRICS-dominated system. So BRICS, strategically long-term vision, long-term goal, is much more important than what's going on in Ukraine. So I think there will be a ceasefire before BRICS formally meets on the 22nd. And also means that whatever's going to happen in the Middle East is going to happen before the 22nd. Now, the Middle East conflict may still continue to be underway, but I think when the internet is taken down, Middle East conflict used as the excuse for the internet collapsing, and that message is conveyed post-reset when the new internet goes live, the finger of blame will be pointed at the Middle East conflict to explain to the world why the internet went down. This conflict in the Middle East may be very massive. It may be very short-lived, but I do think it's going to begin and end before the 22nd of this month. We cannot set aside entirely the possibility, again, the specter of nuclear weapons being used and leading to a global nuclear catastrophe. That needs to be kept in mind. Sorry to bring you such negative news, but that's a snapshot as I see it of what's going on and what I think is going to transpire in the next few days. I do think that because of the pressure on Netanyahu from a variety of sources of pressure, he is going to have to strike Iran and his seven-front war within the next 2 to 3 days. We shall see. God bless you all.